No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined tonight by Chuck Thies, and we're excited to talk to him. He's a local political pundit. He's been in D.C. since 1991. He currently is the Director of Communications for Councilmember Vincent C. Gray from Ward 7. We're happy to have him on the show. If you have a question that you want to ask Chuck, you can call in at 888-627-6008. But other than that, we're going to talk to Chuck about politics and what's going on in D.C., et cetera, et cetera. Chuck, thanks for being on the show tonight.
Well, good evening, Senator Brown. It's great to be here. I really appreciate the invitation. There's a lot going on, both in the district, the nation, and the world. So I assume we'll have plenty of topics to cover. But I do want to make something clear at the outset. It's very important. Although my current job is to be the Director of Communications for Councilmember Gray, who is also, of course, former mayor and former Council Chairman Gray, I am not speaking on behalf of Councilmember Gray today. Reflect those of his office or of him personally or him politically. This is 100% Chuck Thies and no one else.
Of course. Let's talk. I see you on Twitter all the time and a lot of what you're talking about lately, and I think everybody in Washington, D.C. is talking about lately, is crime. Crime is up in the district. Carjackings are way up. Violent crime is up. What do you think's going on, Chuck? I mean, any idea of what we can do about this?
You know, you asked a big question. What do you think is going on? And,
Yeah. You
know, I have been making public statements and trying to raise awareness of the increase in all kinds of crime, which, of course, is led by homicides, murders. I have been talking about this since 2015. You know, in 2011 and 2012, the district saw fewer than 100 murders in each of those years. Now, I'm not saying that 100 murders is a good year, but that was the first time in more than a generation that the district had experienced fewer than 100 murders in a year. And as a matter of fact, the all-time low when council member, then Mayor Gray, was in charge was 88 murders in a year. This year, we're on pace to probably hit somewhere around 240. For two of the past 3 years, we've exceeded 200. So we have more than doubled and may tragically see a tripled murder rate this year from the all-time low just a little more than a decade ago. In order to understand what's happening today, we really have to flip the calendar back about a decade. D.C., a little more than 10 years ago, experienced two back-to-back years where we had fewer than 100 homicides in the city. Now, for context, in two of the past 3 years, we've had more than 200 homicides. The 1 year that we didn't eclipse 200, we only had 198. And this year, we're on pace to have somewhere around 240 homicides. So how in a decade's time did we get from having 88 homicides to 240? And let's keep in mind that when we had 88 homicides, that was a generational low. We hadn't seen numbers under 100 or 200 homicides in decades. So we were doing something right. And the reason why I bring this up is people like to point to COVID and say, oh, well, crime went up during COVID. All these problems are COVID-related. And that's simply not true. We saw the homicide rate begin to tick up in 2015, and with the exception of 1 year, gradually increase to the point where we are now almost triple where we were a decade ago. Triple. Imagine that. The homicide rate has tripled. The juvenile homicide rate last year doubled. This is a crisis. So what is happening? Maybe some of it is COVID, but not all of it, because this trend was happening before COVID. And it's my opinion that there are two or three major factors in the district. I'm not talking around the country. Every city, every community has its own challenges. First and foremost, in D.C., the year that we had 88 homicides, again, a generational low, it is not coincidentally that that is the only time in the past 50 years that we had more than 4,000 sworn officers on the Metropolitan Police Department. 4,000 officers. Every year since then, we have seen fewer and fewer sworn officers for a variety of reasons. There was a retirement bubble. There was some defunding. And there have been workplace conditions that have led cops to retire or resign or quit. And as we see fewer police, we see more murders. We see more violent crimes. We see more excess death in the district. It's just a fact. A lot of people don't like to talk about it, but it is a fact. So that's one thing, the fact that our police department is literally dying on the vine. Secondly, we came out of the 2008 financial crisis in pretty good shape in D.C. as compared to the rest of the country. But as you know, in D.C., and as they say, when America catches an economic cold, the black community in America catches the flu. Fortunately, after the 2008 economic crisis, the black community in D.C. tended to avoid a severe flu. I'm not saying they did as good as the white community, because they didn't, but they tended to avoid that, and there was a lot of stimulus money, a lot of spending, and that spending helps people find opportunity. And that spending, at about the same time that we saw the ranks of the Metropolitan Police Force begin to dwindle, that spending dried up. So you see fewer social programs, you see fewer job opportunities, you see fewer opportunities afforded to people who primarily gravitate toward crime. And then I think the last component and why we've seen a surge in the past few years is just a general sense of lawlessness that, A, our council, the D.C. council, for people around the country who don't know what it is, it's our city council. The D.C. council, the city council, has consistently made things that used to be illegal not illegal. And unfortunately, and especially with young people, when young people see lawlessness, when they see that it's okay to jump the turnstile in the metro and there's no repercussions, they see it's okay to walk into a 7-Eleven and take a bunch of stuff and walk out. They know that you can ride an illegal ATV or mini bike down the street in hordes of 20, 30, 40 packs and literally go up and down Pennsylvania Avenue, up and down Connecticut. When they see that type of lawlessness, young people don't think that laws really are applicable or enforced. And when the politicians actually reinforce that, you get to where we are. So that, to me, is why we are having the type of crime problems that we're having right now. The perfect example is the carjacking. Carjackings are tenfold what they were a decade ago, literally tenfold. Auto thefts are triple what they were just 2019, the year before the pandemic. So what's going on there? Well, in D.C., if you're not a threat to people, if you're not an imminent harm, the police can't chase you. So when you steal a car, if you do 35 and a 25, the cops can't chase you. They're not allowed to. Well, word gets out fast on the internet, social media, word of mouth, right? And so young people are like, hey, man, let's go joyriding. Let's steal a car. And if the cops roll up behind us, just floor it. We'll get away. You know, a young woman was actually killed downtown 3 or 4 days ago. She was driving through an intersection on a green light, and someone T-boned her with enough force to eject her from her vehicle, and she was killed immediately. The two people who were in that automobile fled on foot. Clearly, it was a stolen vehicle, an unauthorized use of vehicle. And this is, as you know, Senator Brown, you drive around D.C. Our roads are not as safe as they were 4 or 5 years ago. It's insane, actually, the things that you see going on. And again, it's because the local politicians have really vilified law enforcement, both the people who enforce the law, police, as well as the general concept that laws are required to operate a civil society. So that's where we are. And unfortunately, the politicians who are responsible for this don't want to admit that they were wrong, because if they admit that they were wrong, not only is this carnage on their hands, but the blood is on their hands. The coffins are stacked at their feet. They don't want to admit it, so they're unwilling to change it. They talk around it. Literally, the juvenile homicide rate doubled. The D.C. Council chairman, Phil Mendelson, is aware of that. He knows that statistic. And when he was asked if there's a crime crisis in D.C., he emphatically, repeatedly said no. Now, let me ask you this, Senator Brown. If I told you that twice as many children died this year from asthma as last year, if I told you twice as many children died trying to walk through a crosswalk on the way to school this year as opposed to last year, or twice as many children died in their homes from lead poisoning, and I asked you, is that a crisis? You would say, yes, that's a crisis. We need to do something. But somehow, the D.C. Council Chairman, Phil Mendelson, doesn't think that when the juvenile homicide rate doubles in a year, it's a crisis. And when politicians refuse to acknowledge that there's a problem, the problem doesn't get solved. That's where we are.
Well, I agree with you 100% about this, Chuck. But I have a couple of follow-up questions about it. First of all, I don't believe that Phil Mendelson's a leader. I think that he was a good bean counter. And I think that, he might have done a great job as a at-large council member. But he's just not a leader. And to be the chairman of the council, I think you have to be a leader. So that's I agree with you. That's a problem that he's out there saying there's no crime. What do we do about it? I mean, did this start when we started to do things like tell people they could jump the metro turnstiles and not pay? Is that the kind of lawlessness you're talking about and the leniency that we're showing, that they're not making arrests for certain things? Is that the problem? Do we need to crack down on that stuff? Do we need to start getting fare cheaters and people that are doing the minor things? You know, they gave the mayor of New York a hard time 20 years ago because he cracked down on all the little misdemeanors. But in the end, the crime rate in New York plummeted. So is that what we need to do? We need to be more hard-assed with things?
Well, they call that broken windows policing. And you'll hear a lot of local politicians say, we can't arrest our way out of this problem. And I disagree. I believe we can't jail our way out of this problem, but we can arrest our way out of this problem. And because when you arrest people, one of the things that Mayor Giuliani did, I lived in New York then. By the way, I came to Washington in 1990. You said at the top of the show it was 1991. Mayor Giuliani was first elected in 1993. And I happened to live in New York, not in D.C., in 1997. I was working on a campaign in Brooklyn at the time that Mayor Giuliani was seeking his first and only reelection. And so I'm sort of steeped in the politics of his approach to crime, which was very popular. And this was a Republican, of course, in a Democratic stronghold. What happens when you arrest people for minor, not minor violations, real violations, right? When you jump the turnstile, you're stealing from the metro and you're stealing from the public and it adds up. But when you arrest people for things of that nature, very often you discover that they have a weapon or they have an outstanding charge. And so by processing then, what you're doing is you're sort of culling the herd and you're finding the bad guys among, or the worst guys among what are just scofflaws, right? You're a scofflaw. You're not a threat to society. You're not a menace to society if you're stealing from Metro by jumping the turnstile. But if you have a ghost gun in your pocket, you're a menace to society. You're a threat to public safety. And so that resulted in a lot of people with outstanding charges. Or in those days, they locked people up for a little bit of weed. Of course, we don't agree with that anymore. But we still lock people up for some hard and dangerous drugs like fentanyl, PCP, things of that nature. So, you know, I'm a law and order guy, but I'm not a lock everyone up and throw away the key guy. And I think it's important. I don't think we should destroy the lives of young people by throwing them in prison. I don't think that we should jail people for offenses that are not serious criminal felonies or nonviolent crimes. But I do believe that we need to enforce laws, because when we don't enforce laws, we have society because we have laws. And when you don't enforce those laws, there are some people who simply won't obey them. That's why there are fines for littering, right? Because there's some people who just litter. There's some people who will just take their trash and throw it in the woods. That happens. We see it. We know it. And when you get caught, there's a fine. That's the deterrent. And some people need to be deterred. And it works. Again, talking to the D.C. Council chairman, he'll tell you, oh, there's no evidence that suggests that harsh penalties or putting people in prison deters crime. That's simply not true. He's selling people a bill of goods when he says that. There are plenty of people who don't do things because there are consequences. And the people who don't care about consequences are the people we have to be concerned with. So what would I do? First and foremost, if you're going to enforce the law, you need law enforcement personnel. First and foremost, I would end the vilification of the police. And let me explain the vilification of the police. Two summers ago, three uniformed police officers patrolling in the 7th District, I believe it was the 7th District, Ward 8, saw a man who they know to deal drugs. And they saw him in the act of dealing drugs. They saw a cash exchange. They saw some furtive behavior. And so they legally, with probable cause, approached him and sought to detain him and question him and search him. He began to resist arrest. During the resist, they saw that he had a weapon, a pistol, in his waistband. And he was, by their account and by the body cam account, reaching for it. The third cop came in and punched the man in the face because he was concerned that he would get to the gun. Now, that's a legal maneuver for the police. It's not called a punch. It's called a straight strike. And it is in the code of conduct for police to deploy a straight strike, to punch you in the face during certain circumstances. And definitely one of those circumstances is when you're reaching for a gun. So what happened? Everyone who was there filmed this. It went viral. And all of a sudden, this man with the gun, who was resisting arrest and dealing drugs, was the hero. And the cops who punched him in the face were vilified. Not only did the local U.S. attorney drop all the charges against the guy with the ghost gun, turned out to be a doubly illegal weapon, and the drugs and the drug dealing, but they sought to press charges against that police officer. And oh yeah, Charles Allen, DC council member Charles Allen, who was the chair of the judiciary at the time, he came out and he was like, bad cop. Phil Mendelson, bad cop. We can't have that in D.C. It's like, what are you talking about? This guy had a gun. A ghost gun, an illegal gun. He was resisting arrest. He was selling drugs. I feel like he's lucky to be alive, to be honest. He got punched in the face. So first and foremost, we need to support police. It's not an easy job. It's a dangerous job. It's a complicated job. It's different every day. and we should be thankful that people risk their lives to keep us safe. So we should support police, not vilify police. We should accept that they have a complex job and that there are heavily armed people who have no compunction about shooting other human beings. We know that because more than 200 people will die in D.C. this year. And we need to support them. And we don't just support them with words. We support them with deeds. And I won't bore your listeners with all of the legislation that the D.C. Council passed, most of which without the mayor's signature, some of which she vetoed, but it was overridden by the council. All of these measures have led the men and women who put on a uniform to keep us safe to say, you know what? I'll find work somewhere else, or I won't get out of my car, or I'll do the bare minimum because, God forbid, I try to take a weapon away from a criminal and I have to punch him in the face because my name will be in the newspaper and my phone will ring at night and I'll get threats from crazy activists. My children will be harassed at school, my wife will be harassed at work, and my life will be destroyed, only because I tried to take a gun away from a guy who was resisting arrest. We need to support the police. Now, I've always said this. Government isn't the best at doing much of anything. But we gotta live with what we got. So what do we want in D.C.? We want the best police department in the country. Right? We want the best teachers. We want the best trash collectors. We want the best road pavers. We want the best tax collectors. We want the best of everything the government can do. So how do you do that? Well, you recruit high quality personnel. You spend a lot of money and a lot of time training them. And then when they're on the job, you support them. That's the only way you get the best. And that's not what is happening because of what the D.C. Council has done to the Metropolitan Police Department. If we want the best of any government agency, we have to respect and support and train and fund and everything else you do to make something work well. And we don't do that here. We don't do that here. Other things we need to do, address the root causes of crime. We know that poverty, we know that a lack of opportunity, we know that families that don't have support, families that are dysfunctional, all of these things lead to crime. We know that there are children who are traumatized by the time they're 3, 4, 5 years old because they come from dysfunctional families that are not getting the support that they need. And so we need to address the root causes of crime, both economic and social. That's really complicated. That's not going to happen in a week, a month, or even a year. That's a slow-moving ship that's not going to turn around on a dime. It's going to take a long, 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 long time. And while we're waiting for that to happen, we can't throw our hands up in the air and say, well, we screwed up as a government for 50 years and neglected people, so we're going to let them shoot each other and break the law. Unfortunately, no. We've got to mop up the mess that we helped to create, and we did through neglect and racism and a bunch of other factors. We've got to mop up that mess and protect the innocent and at the same time address the root causes of crime. It's really, really complicated stuff. But we can't bury our heads in the sand and say, well, some people are violent and upset shooting each other because for years and years and years we neglected these neighborhoods. Oh, well, that's not fair to the innocent men and women and children. We just buried a 10-year-old girl. And not too far away from her, a 12-year-old girl was shot in her own bed. Shot in her own bed. How can that girl ever feel safe again when you're not safe in your own bed? Talk about traumatized.
Well, I got to say, you know, I don't read the Washington Post every day without seeing that somebody else has been killed and the murder you just brought up of a little girl who was doing nothing more than riding in her car. A pallbearer was shot at her funeral and killed. I mean, the whole thing you talk about lawlessness, Chuck, is so happening. It's so scaring people in Ward 3. I can tell you, people in Ward 3 generally aren't concerned about violent crime, but now they certainly are. And certainly I think you're right that a lot of this lays at the feet of the politicians in D.C. Let me tell you, I took a lot of criticism for calling the council petulant children when they sent that crime bill up to Capitol Hill, which was summarily rejected. First time in more than 30 years, they garnered many, many Democrats to get the, you know, over 40 Democrats signed on to reject the bill. And I knew it was going to get rejected. Everybody seemed to know in Washington it was going to get rejected, but the city council didn't seem to know that. And then Phil, the chairman, said that he was going to revamp the bill. And first he tried to pull it out, which is illegal. And then he said he was going to revamp the bill and send it back. But that's not going to help. And the mayor vetoed the bill, and she vetoed it on the basis that there were certain aspects of it that she didn't like. And those are the same things that the members of Congress didn't like. So, I mean, what do we need to do to get through to the city council, you think?
So, you know, it's funny because and when I say funny, I mean tragic. For quite some time, and certainly during the pandemic, I would refer to the council as breathing its own fumes. They're not in touch. They live in a bubble. They're not in touch with as many people as you would think local politicians are. They preach to the choir. They go to the same meetings over and over again. They see the same people over and over again. And these are all good people, but they tend to hear what they want to hear, and they don't hear a whole lot of input from the people whose opinions and whose concerns they're not interested in hearing, because they come in the form of criticism. And I'll talk about what happens when you criticize the council in a little bit, because it's really interesting what they do. What is up with the council? One of the problems with the council is that some of the members, a while back in the advent of social media, realized that when you say something like, let's take guns away from police, remember when former council member David Grosso said that? Well, the people who think that's a good idea, of course, those people are imbeciles, but the people who think that's a good idea cheer the loudest. They cheer the loudest. Let's legalize prostitution. Yay! Yay! Let's take guns away from police. Yay! Let's no longer suspend the licenses of people who don't pay traffic tickets. Yay! Yay! And so these members, that's their focus group. That's their peanut gallery. And so they hear all this cheering, and they're like, let's do it. Okay, let me find some other crazy idea, and I'll do that too, because that's where I get all the cheers and the back slapping. And so that's part of the problem. And then another part of the problem is they get caught up in the moment. I want to be clear. George Floyd was murdered. He wasn't killed. He wasn't the victim of police abuse or excessive use of force. George Floyd was murdered, period. And where he was murdered, clearly, the police department had allowed behavior similar to what resulted in his death to go on unchecked. And there was a massive, massive public awareness around that murder. There were massive protests, justifiable and thankfully that they happened, and there were positive changes in policing in jurisdictions where changes needed to happen. What never should have become a battle cry is defund the police, which several council members echoed and actually made policy and bragged about how they were reducing the size of the D.C. Police Department and how they were cutting funding. But in addition to defund should never have been a battle cry, what should have happened in D.C. and what council member Anita Bonds and council member Vincent Gray sought to do was, let's not get caught up in the moment, children, meaning younger members. Let's not get caught up in the hashtags and the street protests. Let's do our job as thoughtful legislators and make sure that the changes that we make are in the best interest of public safety. But unfortunately, that's not what happened. Now, Gray and Bonds proposed the Police Reform Commission, and that was to slow down the process. Let's not change everything right away. Let's not get caught up in the moment. Let's be thoughtful, because we don't have a police abuse problem in D.C. Have we had some cops do some terrible things in D.C.? Absolutely. Absolutely. Every profession has bad actors. Teachers, doctors, lawyers, Olympic gymnast coaches. Every profession has bad actors. It's just part of the human condition, and we need to get rid of them. But the reality is that the system doesn't enable the bad actor in D.C. The bad actor is the problem. But, oh, no, what did Phil Mendelson do? He stacked the Police Reform Commission with a bunch of far-left-wing, proven cop-hating activists, advocates, and politicians. And they adopted a set of rules and regulations that have, again, led to lawlessness and encouraged police to leave the police force. And let me give you a perfect example of how absurd this is. No doubt that George Floyd was murdered, period. One of the things that Phil Mendelson and Charles Allen, the two primary sponsors of the so-called police reform legislation in D.C., one of the things that they will tell you repeatedly, they said it so much the President of the United States believes it, and his spokesperson reiterated it. One of the things that they will tell you is that, well, this law will prevent, will make illegal what happened to George Floyd. It'll make that illegal in D.C. So what they want you to believe is that before George Floyd was murdered, that in D.C., if a cop strangled someone to death, choked someone to death, used a neck restraint, that's the technical term, and the person died, that was okay. They want you to believe in D.C. that's why they passed all these laws, to make what happened to George Floyd illegal in D.C., as though it was legal in D.C. beforehand. 2 days before the President of the United States decided to not overturn the police reform legislation that Congress sought his support on, 2 days before he upheld the mess that Charles Allen and Phil Mendelson created for policing in D.C., 2 days before that, the United States Attorney for the District of Columbia announced the conviction stemming from a 2018 incident whereby a D.C. police officer compromised someone's civil rights and killed them with what? A chokehold. It was illegal before George Floyd died to do that in D.C. But they wanted everyone to believe it wasn't. They used George Floyd's death as propaganda for political purposes. It is shameless, if not disgusting. They lied. They pretended that someone could suffer the same fate as George Floyd in D.C. at the hands of a police officer, and it would be lawful. And they knew that wasn't true. So that's part of the problem, the vilification of the police. And now it's codified into law. D.C. is a union town. D.C. is one of the bluest towns in the country. 96% of the people in this city did not vote for Donald Trump. How blue can it get? This is a union town. This is a strong union town. But the D.C. Council, the mayor didn't sign this legislation, the D.C. Council eliminated the D.C. police union's ability to participate fully in collective bargaining. Unions don't exist without collective bargaining. Unions don't exist without collective bargaining. That's the purpose of a union. And the D.C. Council stripped the rights of the D.C. Police Union to participate fully in collective bargaining. That's a fact. They don't have the same rights as teachers, as sanitation workers, as administrative assistants, as anyone any other district government employee. There is in this city a legitimate war on police, and Charles Allen and Phil Mendelson led it, and the rest of the council followed blindly because social media loved it. because hashtag defund the police. Because no one thought, what might happen if we get to where we only have 3,200 police officers in a city that once had 4,000? What might happen if police don't get out of their cars because they no longer have legal protections? And in fact, they're charged with crimes when they have to use violence to take a weapon from someone, an illegal weapon from someone. That is what is wrong with Washington, D.C. today. And you have
Chuck, this is something that blows me away, especially with Charles Allen. They seem to embrace every silly-ass idea, progressive idea that comes down the pike. The idea of letting non-documented immigrants vote in D.C. elections. Now, they thought this was going to go through Congress, that they were going to let citizens, people that are undocumented, all you have to do is come into Washington for 30 days and you can vote. I mean, hell, at the last hearing, they suggested that a former employee of the Chinese embassy or the Russian embassy could run for mayor without being a citizen.
Absolutely. The hundreds of people who work in Chinese and Russian embassies would be eligible to vote in our elections.
Yeah.
But there's no logic. Remember, there's no logic. Charles Allen, as chair of the Judiciary Committee, sought to lower the voting age to 16. He's like, well, 16-year-olds have opinions.
We don't let them
right?
drive,
no, but
Chuck.
Hang on, this is how crazy it is. 16-year-olds, this is what he said, 16-year-olds have opinions. They're able to understand some of the work we do. At the same time, he says, oh, you know what? No one under 25 has a fully formed brain and therefore should be treated like an adult after they commit a crime. So there's no logic there. If you're 16, you can vote. But if you're 25, get out of jail free because your brain isn't fully formed yet. There's no logic there. Again, he's pandering for the hashtags, for the applause to the peanut gallery. Charles is actually a very smart man. I first met Charles Allen when he was fresh out of college. He was a kid out of college, and I was working on Howard Dean's campaign, and he was a local organizer, a volunteer on the campaign here in D.C. And I was like, wow, this is a sharp young kid. Yeah, he's a bright kid. And then ultimately he went to work for then Ward 6 council member Tommy Wells and became his chief of staff and pretty much was, you know, people would refer to Karl Rove as Bush's brain. Well, people would refer to Charles as Tommy's brain. And Tommy's a very intelligent man. That's sort of a slight of Tommy Wells. I don't agree with that. But he was the policy guy. And you know, he pushed left-leaning policies, but in those days, primarily on the environment. And there were good ideas. There were good ideas. Some of them were you know, you're just your typical virtue signaling dog and pony show things like laying down sod in front of the Wilson Building and turning parking spots into parks. That's all well and good. They do it for a day. They take pictures and then they lift the sod up. But most of his work was on the environment. And we can probably stand to move a little left on the environment. Look around. You saw the smoke in the skies. But he has no background in criminal justice. He has no background in public safety. He's not a lawyer. He shouldn't have even been the chair of the Judiciary Committee. Phil Mendelson made him chair. I have no idea why. The D.C. Council has plenty of lawyers. Why do we have someone who isn't a lawyer running the Judiciary Committee? And look what we get. Why wouldn't you have someone, it's the Judiciary and Public Safety Committee, by the way, why wouldn't you have someone with some public safety background on that committee? And if you don't have anyone on the council with public safety background, at least a lawyer, so they can understand what the repercussions of changing laws are. That's what lawyers are trained to do, in part. But let's talk about the council for a second, because I need to talk about myself. About a month and a half ago, I put up a series of tweets. By the way, if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's Chuck Thies, T-H-I-E-S, Chuck Thies at Twitter.com. I put up a series of tweets where I criticized a couple of council members, in particular Council Chairman Phil Mendelson, for saying that there wasn't a crime crisis when, as I said earlier, the juvenile homicide rate had doubled. I don't know. I see that as a crisis. Call me crazy. And I really got upset at one point because in the process of putting up those tweets, Then we experienced a string of really, all murders are tragic, but in particular, tragic murders. If you remember the woman who was visiting D.C. for a concert and she was murdered in her hotel room by a crazy guy who had multiple charges and should have never been released. As a matter of fact, they just figured out that the guy who killed the kid on the metro a few weeks ago, he had absconded. He was awaiting sentencing for having a gun and carjacking and had absconded, hadn't showed up because they let him out. As opposed to, you know, in my opinion, if you have a gun and you're a carjacker and you've been convicted and you're awaiting sentencing, you should stay in jail while you're awaiting sentencing. But no, that's not what happened. So he went on to murder someone. So now there's a 17-year-old boy who doesn't get to live out his life because we have nonsensical law enforcement. But anyway, I was pointing things out like this on Twitter. And usually I point things out very matter-of-factly, and sometimes I add a little commentary or some drama. But something happened, and I forget what it was, that really upset me. It was probably a child dying or some innocent woman or whatever. It was something that was completely awful. And I think I called the council chairman a monster or something like that. And I also pointed out the fact that the Ward 4 council member, who is a big-time defund the police supporter, had voted to remove school resource officers, to defund the school resource officers, police in our school who protect children, confiscate weapons, and do all kinds of good things, actually. And lo and behold, the D.C. Council is having a meeting. It's called an administrative meeting where they talk about things like how much money they're going to spend on the Pride Parade and when their vacation is going to happen. And they add to the agenda me. They want to complain about my tweets because I work on the council. And they have this long conversation, 20 minutes, about how inappropriate it is for a citizen of the United States who is protected by the First Amendment, how inappropriate it is for me to have the audacity to criticize council members because I work in the council. Let me be clear. My boss, I only have one boss. His name is Vincent C. Gray. He never once criticized me or told me to shut up. I'm not saying he approved my tweets, but he's the only person who could say, hey, Chuck, you can say whatever you want, but you work for me. And if you don't like it, well, I can fire you or you can quit. But no, he didn't say that. And again, I'm not saying he approved my tweets, but you know what he approves of? The protection that the First Amendment affords you. And I never tweeted as though it was reflective of Councilmember Gray's opinion. And I never tweeted on company time. But the council didn't like that, and they convened this meeting, and they sought, literally two council members said, can we find a way to silence him? Can we find a way to make this stop? I mean, they're so sensitive to criticism about something that they deserve to be criticized about. They literally thought that they could figure out some way to strip me of my First Amendment privilege simply because I work at the D.C. Council. It's insane. It's literally insane. It's like living in a banana republic. And I talked to the chairman about this. I said, first of all, 20 years ago, I ran your first reelection campaign, Phil Mendelson. You have my phone number. We regularly would go out to breakfast and share political intel and shoot the breeze. And I'd see him all over the city at campaign events, political events, and we'd talk. And we've agreed and disagreed over the years, as people in politics do. But I'm like, what are you doing having a meeting in front of cameras to talk about my tweets? Do you realize how silly you look? Do you realize that even if people don't like me, when the government says that person needs to be silenced, everyone will side with me, not you. Not you.
Well, that's crazy. And, you know, I'm a pariah with the council and the mayor because I do the same thing, Chuck. I say things that they don't like that criticizes them. I say that you can't make statehood a priority in the District of Columbia and spend over $1 billion on education and spend $200,000 a year trying to get people their basic civil rights. And they don't like that. So, you know, I never get invited to anything. I never get anything discussed with me. And yeah, it is crazy that they're that thin skinned, because I'll tell you what, Congress has the right to disband the council or to impose martial law, which they did. You know, they did with the control board. They can do that again. And these guys don't realize what a precarious position they are in, especially since you mentioned the truth that the city's all blue. It's all blue. We're the most democratic jurisdiction in America, and these guys are running for re-election in 2024, and they're going to hold the District of Columbia up as an example of what goes wrong when you let Democrats run things. And I don't think these guys are getting that message that, hey, these people are coming after y'all. They're not just, you know, working in their supervisory role. They have an agenda, and it's going beautifully for them, and these guys are playing right into it. So let me ask you.
I told Phil Mendelson, I told it right to his face. I told him in the halls of what we call it, the Wilson Building. Everyone knows it as City Hall. And I said, Phil, you risk being the poster child for soft on crime Democratic politics. And just two or three days ago, Fox News had a national report about soft on crime D.C. But it's not just Fox News. It was the regular Sunday shows on the other networks. It was the Wall Street Journal writing a lengthy editorial. And there are these high profile events that happen. For example, when the member of Congress was assaulted in the elevator of her own apartment building, when you're not safe in the elevator of your own apartment building. And so and there was also a member of Congress, I believe it was one of Rand Paul's staffers, was shot or beat or whatever. He was severely injured, life-changing injuries. These things, I've warned politicians of this for years. When crime becomes the story, there's an old expression in newsrooms, if it bleeds, it leads. And it's because it generates clicks. It galvanizes eyeballs. And when crime becomes a story, nothing pushes it off the front pages, nothing pushes it off the evening news until the crime goes away. That doesn't mean every night. You know, it's tragic, but if a 20-year-old black man is killed in Ward 8 tonight in a garden variety gang member shooting, it won't be on television. There'll be a blurb maybe an inch long in the Washington Post. But when a 10-year-old girl is killed, or when a Lululemon store is looted on 14th Street, or there's a shooting in front of Les Diplomat or at the baseball stadium or blocks from the White House, everyone is reminded that D.C. is a soft-on-crime jurisdiction. And that won't go away until the crime stops. That's the only thing that makes it go away. You can never, ever, ever lose that branding once you've been called soft on crime, because everything that you do, and we're seeing this with the council right now, everything that you do afterwards makes it seem reactionary. For example, Charles Allen, one of the most prolific defunders and anti-cop politicians the city has ever seen. But when there was a high-profile murder in a metro station where a metro employee tried to be a hero and save someone else's life and ended up giving his own in the process, Charles Allen had to come out, bite his tongue, and say, oh, maybe we need more police. You know, we need more police. We need more law enforcement. It's like, this is the very guy who literally bragged that he was trying to reduce the size of the police department. So when he comes out and tries to say, look, I'm not soft on crime, we need more police, no one believes it. Maybe people who weren't paying attention look at this guy and say, oh, there's a law and order guy, I kind of like him. But most people don't believe it because they know that he's responsible for the problem. Same thing with Phil Mendelson. There's no crime crisis. Oh, yeah, we don't need this many police in D.C. Well, now all of a sudden, we're burying 10-year-old girls. 12-year-old girls are getting shot in bed. Women visiting from Virginia are being killed in their hotel rooms. Our roads are as deadly as they've been in decades. Phil Mendelson's on the radio on Friday. Well, 3,300 police officers might not be enough. We need maybe some more. He wouldn't put a number on it, but we need maybe some more. No one believes that. Everyone knows he's just being reactionary. Everyone knows he's trying to cover up for the mess that he helped to create. And no one politician is responsible for this, but chief among them are Phil Mendelson and Charles Allen. And you can put a little Ward 1 council member Brienne Nadeau and Ward 4 council member Janice Lewis-George in there. They're very active defunders.
Well, the scariest thing, Chuck, is there are very few people like you that are out there talking about this. And, you know, I often say the council tries to use the Jedi mind trick on people, you know. There's nothing going on here. These aren't the droids you're looking for. There's, you know, everything's fine. But you're right. It's not. And unfortunately for you and I right now, we're running out of time. We only have a few minutes left. So is there anything else you want to say, Chuck, that I haven't asked you? Obviously, I've got to have you back sometime because there's so much.
I do. I want to say this because you pointed something out, and that is there are very few people talking about it. And here's why.
Yes.
Because for the longest period of time, if you said something like, we need more police, we need to get a handle on crime, people point at you and call you racist if you're white. Oh, you're a racist. You just want to lock up a bunch of black people. That's not true. I actually want to help to save the lives of black people.
Protect them from violent crime. The victims, they never talk about them. You know?
Right.
Right. And they're all black people.
So be brave. Be brave and speak out about nonsense. You know, for the longest time, you get shouted down on Twitter and you get shouted down on social media, or you even got shouted down just trying to have a conversation with people in a room. But the worm has turned, unfortunately, because there's blood in the streets. So speak out and say, no, we need to support police. Yes, we need to take violent criminals off the street and incarcerate them. If you're a repeat violent offender, we have an obligation to protect innocent people from you.
Yes.
So speak out and vote, vote, and vote every single one of these people out of office as soon as you get an opportunity, as soon as you get an opportunity.
Well, that's a great place to end our conversation tonight, Chuck, because that's absolutely true. That's the way that you have to deal with it. So, I hope sometime we can get you to come back. Depending on, you know, everybody's availability. But I really would like to have you back because there's so many other things to talk about. And you're right on about this. So thank you so much for talking truth to power, because there's very few people in the District of Columbia that are willing to do that. And I so much appreciate you being able to do that. So thanks for being on the show. At the end of each show, we play a song in honor of our guests. And tonight, because I'm an old hippie, Chuck, I've chosen Buffalo Springfield. And this goes out to you and everybody in D.C. What's going on, folks? Thanks. Tune in next week.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me.
Representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.